Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any appeal to authority. My guest today is the writer and journalist Mark Vernon, who's here to talk to us today about agnosticism, what he understands by the term, why it's important, and how he feels it's useful to adopt such an approach in life. Welcome to the MWS podcast, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Okay, could you start off by telling us something about your life and background?
Yeah, I began my professional life as a priest in the Church of England. That didn't work out for me. I did a curacy, but left for all sorts of reasons, really. But part of that was a kind of intellectual reason. And I left a very convinced atheist. But I had to own up myself to being sort of very interested in the spiritual dimension, you might say, and have gradually found my way back to a kind of theism through this notion of the agnostic element. The way that God is ultimately unknown and unknowable to we human beings. I feel that that tradition has rather got lost in the West. So that's why this subject of agnosticism really engages me and interests me.
A couple of years ago, you wrote the book How to Be Agnostic. So was that your principal motivation for writing that? And what were your main aims with the book?
Yeah, it was in a way. It was partly personal, partly exploratory. And I guess that, you know, part of this whole unknown theme is something that's experienced as much as talked about. The ancient skeptics had a very nice way of putting it, I think, that human beings live on the edge of a circle. And inside the circle is what we know. We do know certain things. But outside the circle is what we don't know. And the nice thing about the analogy is that as the circle gets bigger, as what we know increases, as it were, so too does our contact with that which is unknown get bigger because the circumference grows.
Yeah.
And they argue that the art of living was to kind of live on the edge of this circle. Sometimes we want to rush to the middle where we are certain of everything, but then life becomes a bit cramped. But on the other hand, if you step out completely into the unknown, then you get completely lost. So there's a kind of art to living on the edge. And I try to explore that in the book, both in terms of philosophy, like the skeptical tradition, but also in terms of experience.
Okay. So in terms of philosophy, do you in many ways associate philosophy with the way the Hellenistic philosophers approached that, that it was a way of life, something to practice rather than some dry intellectual subject?
Yeah, it was a combination of both. You know, it was lived in the marketplace for many ancient philosophers, where you brought your whole person to bear upon what you were thinking about, what you were experiencing and trying to live. And it took many years, you know, it was a kind of transformation of the soul to get to understand these things. And I think that they all, in some way, the different schools of the ancient philosophies were a response to Socrates. Mm-hmm. And Socrates, if you like, is the patron saint of the unknown elements of life. I think that the reason why he's such a seminal figure is that to have an encounter with him was to somehow become aware of how being human is a bit like treading water on vast oceans of unknownness. And many people didn't like that, of course, and Socrates ultimately paid for his life, I think, paid with his life for trying to open up that dimension of life. But luckily for us, enough people were engaged by that. And the skeptics, followers of Plato, others, they all try and grapple with what it might mean to live a Socratic way of life, to be open to this dimension that we human beings are the in-between creatures, as Plato put it, that we're not just completely ignorant like presumably other animals are and sort of blissful in that, but then neither are we like the gods who presumably see it all, and we're somewhere in between. And this in-between status is both the source of all our creativity and desire, our inspiration in life, but also, you know, can ruin and destroy us because it's never completely satisfied.
A criticism that is often directed at agnostics is that they sit on the fence and can't make their mind up. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, I think the word agnostic has come to mean that a lot in the modern world, in common parlance. It has come to me in a kind of whatever, don't really care, doesn't interest me. And you know, I think that's just the case. The word can be used like that, but it's not the kind of agnosticism I mean at all. And in fact, it's not the kind of agnosticism that Huxley meant when he coined the phrase. He did say that his agnosticism was a kind of acknowledgement of the limits of human understanding. And he traced a kind of a tradition of that that goes back to Socrates, but all the way through Christian traditions as well.
I think you used a term in your book. You described yourself as a conviction agnostic. Would that be an appropriate term?
Yeah. I mean, I think what I mean by that is I think actually to be a theist is actually to also be an agnostic, because the first thing that you can be sure if you believe in God is that you don't know God fully. To feel that you do know God is not actually to believe in God. It's to have created an idol. You know, so when Moses goes up the mountain in the Hebrew Bible, he doesn't come to a full realization of God. He ascends into darkness and cloud. And that theme is very common in spiritual traditions that try to pursue a path to God, the cloud of unknowing, as it's called in the medieval text. So I think that although it sounds a bit paradoxical because of this common use of the word agnostic, agnosticism and theism actually go together.
On that subject, I don't know if you've ever come across the Chinese expression sometimes to describe the religion as the great matter of birth and death. For me personally, I find that there's something rather than nothing mind-boggling, but I like that. I'm not looking for an answer. I think where religions maybe go wrong is by trying to provide answers to such imponderable questions. Now in your book you seem to talk about the various mystical traditions in this light in some way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that what we've lost in a way is a sense that answers, in inverted commas, can operate in different registers. And we've got very obsessed with literal answers. Perhaps it's not surprising in an age in which empirical science has had such incredible success and so shapes our lives. But we've lost touch with, you know, analogical, with the metaphorical, with the mystical itself. Mm-hmm. In poems, phrases can be sort of answers, but they're the kind of answers which throw you more deeply onto questions,
yeah,
rather than rounding it all off. And we've lost touch with that ability to engage with life in that kind of way so much in the modern world. So it's not surprising that theism, you know, becomes a kind of fundamentalism. Do you believe in it or not? Can you prove it or not? Mm-hmm. It's a very kind of thinned out discussion.
I've noticed on the web that you have an interest in the work of Ian McGilchrist, who's the patron of the Middleway Society. How does his idea of the divided brain tie in with agnosticism and ethics potentially as well?
Well, I don't know whether Ian has said this to you, but he has certainly said to me that his, you know, fantastic book, The Master and His Emissary, is a kind of spiritual book, because he tries to explore what this awareness of the implicit in the world might be like. He feels that we live in a culture which has become very dominated by an explicit awareness, which can be focused, manipulated, controlled, and, you know, that's all very important, but it's to the detriment of that which is implicit, that which we evoke, and that which we show rather than tell, that's that side of life. And in a world which has lost that awareness of things, it's not surprising that the spiritual has a problem, because it's up against the way of seeing that actually sort of throttles it in the process. So I think Ian's attempt to using brain science to at least say, look, there is a different way of looking at the world, is really, really crucial. And I mean, I think I have a lot of concerns about the way brain science is used, but he recognises that it's a very powerful discourse now, and so makes the case very profoundly.
And with that in mind, and also from how you approach this in your book, how would you say adopting an agnostic position in life can help you ethically approach life?
Well, I guess that it's two ways. One would be a kind of modesty, humility, to recognize what's always unknown, not just in terms of the big questions, but in terms of, you know, everyday human encounters. And we hardly know ourselves, let alone other people. and that evokes a certain kind of modesty in terms of engaging with others. But I think also it speaks to the virtue ethics tradition, which again is a sort of minority concern in the modern world. But in virtue ethics, the idea is to cultivate the habits, the character, the personality that doesn't have answers, but as it were, hopefully puts you in the best position to live a flourishing life. Mm-hmm. You know, utilitarianism and deontological ethics, the main strands in modern ethics, are really about providing answers. This is what is good, this is what is bad.
Yeah.
Virtue ethics doesn't say that. It says, look, if we develop these habits, these characteristics, these capacities as human beings, then the good and the bad might, you know, gradually emerge for us. We'll understand them more deeply. So virtue ethics is, by its very nature, a more sort of agnostic approach to life.
Okay, yeah. Middle way practitioners tend to see all three ethical strategies, consequentialism, rule-based ethics, and virtue ethics, as useful tools in one's ethical toolbox, choosing the appropriate one or combination for the situation, rather than one of them being the ethical strategy. I mean, all of them have practical ways of addressing conditions. For example, consequentialism helps you to face up to consequences. Rule-based theories help you to be consistent, and virtue ethics helps you, you know, long term. But they all have their drawbacks too. Does that resonate with you at all?
I guess to a degree, but I feel that it's time for virtue ethics to make more of a stand, because I think particularly utilitarianism is so dominant that its downside is also very, very powerful. You know, the way that everything becomes a kind of calculation.
Yeah.
It's, you know, the world becomes ruled by the accountancy or the bureaucratic mindset. And I think that is so pervasive now that, sure, you know, there's a certain place for utilitarianism, but the way it so shapes the way we think about the world really needs addressing. So I want to make more of a stand for virtue ethics.
I could agree with that. I think we need a balance. I think we're a bit out of kilter there with all three of them, aren't we?
Yeah. I guess maybe I'd want to be a bit more, a bit more bullish about knocking utilitarianism, but maybe at the end point to address some kind of balance.
And then you're also an admirer of Jung. What do you make of his statement, "I don't believe in God, but I know him"?
Yeah, well, he made this very provocative statement at the end of his life, famously in that interview, didn't he? And I guess what he meant was that he had come to a felt awareness of the divine that was so much now part of the way that he saw the world, that it wasn't a statement of belief anymore, but in some profound sense, a way of engaging with the world that felt like a knowing the world. I don't think he meant that he knew God sort of face to face. But that somehow so much of what he'd explored through his life rested on the unknown God, you know, through his engagement with symbols, through his engagement with the unconscious, and through his engagement with the myths of the world and so on, that he had come to a place where it wasn't so much that he knew God, but that he couldn't doubt the divine.
Yeah, okay. Well, just staying on the subject of meaning, you studied Plato for your PhD, and he had arguably a representational view of meaning, especially in regard to the forms, etc. Do you see meaning in this representational way, or do you see meaning more, can meaning also be something in an embodied way based on our experience?
Now you got me onto a big thing here, because my PhD was basically about how people misunderstand Plato. Modestly put, it was really partly to say that the thing about Plato is that he explores all sorts of possibilities,
yeah,
and never definitively says this is what I believe. You know, he's kind of like Shakespeare. If you go around asking what does Shakespeare believe, you lose the point of his plays. And I think that if you go around asking what did Plato believe, you do so similarly. I think a fundamental issue for Plato is that philosophy is not read on the page. It's lived in a life and a way of life. And that's why he wrote dialogues and only dialogues. We know that. Now, it's true that he does explore representational kinds of knowledge in various points, but he, of course, also undermines them equally successfully. And he's a great inventor of myth as well. You know, the myth of Atlantis, the myth of the cave, all these are Plato's creations. And I think that they were equally as important in his toolkit, you might say, of how he can engage with the world as any kind of representational theory. And even the forms which you mentioned there, you know, it pops up in various dialogues and in completely different ways. Sometimes the forms are the awareness that grows out of the ascent of love. You know, it's not a representational notion at all. So I think Plato's constantly toying with different ideas, knowing that none of them will finally settle. But in a life, a sense of things can grow.
He learns his lessons well from his teacher then.
Yeah, I think he was a true follower of Socrates, you know, knowing that you know nothing for sure. But he develops, I think, particularly actually through this prism of love, this desire for what we lack and long for, and the way that beauty and the good, the true, that draws us as much as any logical series of, you know, a debate.
Just staying on that subject of love and the definition, the desire for what we lack, can that in some way square up with Jung's idea of individuation?
I mean, maybe. You know, so Jung's idea of individuation would be that we lose touch with a part of ourselves, which he called the shadow, for all sorts of personal reasons. It becomes distasteful, unpalatable, frightening to us. And so we push it away and it falls into the shadow. And individuation is about trying to recover that lost part of us, ourselves. So that we become fuller, richer human beings rather than constantly shaping ourselves by that which we're afraid of. You know, the thing about loving what you lack is that you have a sense of it. If you didn't have some sense of it, you wouldn't know that you lacked it. So you couldn't love it in Plato. And I guess that, you know, the side of us which we lose touch with, but that we have some sense of, if only through our fear, love would be the way of trying to draw it back to ourselves, and so becoming more individuated in Jung's sense. So perhaps I could see the two coming together in some way like that.
Okay, and then what is your understanding of the middle way, and how could that tie in to what we've been talking about?
Well, and the way that the phrase strikes me is through Buddhism, I guess, you know, the Buddha's way. Traditionally be known as the middle way. So it was neither ascetic extremism, as he tried, so the stories go, and found that didn't work, but neither is it pure indulgence. There's a kind of art to life, you might say. I rather like in Buddhism this use of the word right, you know, right effort, right mindfulness, right living. And it suggests a kind of balance that, you know, in right effort, you've got to put some effort in. But if your effort becomes too possessive and clinging and holding, then you undermine what you're trying to do. So there's a kind of easing off, a letting go as well in right effort. But these things are only learned when through experience, through practice, through making mistakes. I think it fits very well with virtue ethics in that respect. It's something that it's a practical intelligence, a practical wisdom, rather than, again, something which you can just read on the page. Yeah, so I like that's what the middle way speaks to me of immediately.
And would you say Aristotle's golden mean, which ties in with virtue ethics, has a correlation there?
Yeah, I mean, his idea that you know what courage is, for example, because it's in between foolhardiness and timidity. And again, that's something which you kind of you have to judge through the course of a life. You become better at arriving at the courageous position. Rather than just, it's not a calculation. It is something that's felt. It's the educated heart, as Aristotle put it, that knows about these things. That would speak to it too. Yeah.
Yeah. And is there a middle way in Christianity? And if so, can you think of any examples?
Yeah, it's not a phrase, as far as I know, that's used in Christianity in such a direct way.
But as a sentiment.
As a sentiment, well, it reminds me of Plato's expression, which we were talking about, what I was mentioning here, this idea that we're the in-between creature. We're neither sort of, you know, blissfully happy, like my pet cats are, for example, but neither are we all-knowing in the way that the gods might be. And Platonism is, you know, very profoundly influential in Christianity. So Augustine, a great Platonist theologian, he picks up this phrase and renders it more poetically by saying, we are between the beasts and the angels.
Uh-huh.
That's what it is to be human, to live this in-between life. And I guess that's a sort of another take on the middle way, you might say, that we're finite creatures that have a taste for the infinite. You know, we're mortals that have a taste for immortality. So living that well, so that it inspires us rather than destroys us, is part of the middle way too, I suppose.
Now, you describe yourself, as you say, as a Christian agnostic. Can one as easily be a Hindu agnostic or a Muslim or a humanist agnostic?
I suppose that the Christian bit for me means, apart from anything else, it doesn't mean the theistic bit. I think, an atheist agnostic would be different, if that's what the humanist bit in your question means. And lots of isms rattling around here now. I think in terms of attitude and stance towards the big questions, this sense that our understanding of things as much opens up what we don't know as much as what we do know, that could be replicated in many spheres. Whether or not you'd go the metaphysical step,
yeah.
I don't know. But as an attitude or a stance, you find common ground with many different kinds of people, I'm sure.
Okay, well, it's been really interesting to talk to you today, Mark. Thank you very much for giving up your time today.
Yeah, well, thanks for speaking as well. It was fun.
You can find out more about Middle Way Philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.